You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So we're very privileged to welcome Mary Miller, the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. Mary serves as the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. In that position, she's responsible for developing and coordinating Treasury's policies and guidance in the areas of financial institutions, federal debt financing, financial regulation, and capital markets. Previously, she served as the Assistant Secretary for Financial Markets. Prior to joining the Treasury, Miller spent 26 years working for T. Rowe Price, where she was the Director of Fixed Income Division and a member of the firm's Management Committee. She earned her BA from Cornell and then MCRP from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She also is a Chartered Financial Analyst designation. And just to go off the page a little bit, I think everybody that I run into has said what a great person Mary is, how knowledgeable and how sharp. And it's a great privilege that we have her in the Treasury and an even greater privilege that she's here to talk to us today. Mary Miller.
Thank you so much for the introduction and, of course, the opportunity to come and talk about this important topic today. So since the 2008 financial crisis, there has been, rightly so, a great deal of focus on ensuring that banks have significantly more capital and higher quality capital. However, in the midst of a crisis, in the moment, liquidity can be even more important. Modern central banks are designed to provide banks with access to liquidity in a crisis. That is the essence of their lender of last resort function. The Basel III reforms will require banks to significantly increase their liquidity buffers with a liquidity coverage ratio and net stable funding ratio. These reforms should decrease reliance on central bank liquidity, but may require other trade-offs. As I understand it, the panels this morning largely focused on the debate over who should be the primary provider of liquidity in a crisis. That is, the degree to which firms should be required to self-insure by holding large liquidity buffers versus relying on the central bank's lender of last resort function. Rather than reprise those debates, I thought I would talk about financial market liquidity. Of course, banks and other financial institutions are intimately connected to financial markets, but focusing on market liquidity can help us think through a series of other questions. I don't necessarily have the answers to these questions, but I thought they were important ones to ask as we consider the issue of liquidity broadly. Let me start with the definition of liquidity in a financial context. Liquidity is a measure of the ability and ease with which assets can be converted to cash. Further definition might address the ability to sell without driving down the price. I should probably add here that I spent my years before Treasury working as a fixed income asset manager and a consumer of market liquidity. Having weathered many difficult market downturns over 25 years, both interest rate and credit driven, nothing compared to the financial crisis of 2008. And I'm going to just diverge for a moment and talk about a particular experience I remember from the fall of 2008, which was a day when we needed to raise cash in a portfolio, and we attempted to sell a block of $10 million of a household name corporate bond, highly rated, I think it was AA+. So we did what we usually did. We went to the Bloomberg screen, and we put the bond out for competitive bid to 30 brokers. Within moments, we had the answer. We had one bid, and one bid that was 10 points below the market valuation of the security that we were attempting to sell. So that had rather important ramifications because we held lots of bonds that looked like this bond, and if we trade the bond 10 points below the market valuation, that sort of resets the pricing of everything you have in your portfolio. So what did we do? We didn't trade the bond. We said, you know, we asked for 30 bids. We got one. That's not really a market. We turned to some electronic trading platforms. We put the block of bonds out for bid. And over a period of a day or two, we sold the block at our market value. So that raised a lot of questions in my mind about, you know, what is market liquidity? How do you ascertain prices? How do you execute in environments like this? And importantly, it was teaching me the difference between credit-impaired assets and liquidity-impaired assets. And I'd never worked through a market where we had quite as much difficulty in terms of sourcing liquidity. So back to liquidity. I think there are different ways to think about liquidity and the ways that recent developments in financial regulation and market practice are evolving. First, we can talk about the liquidity of financial instruments. Which instruments have the properties to be readily converted to cash? Regulators have gone a long way to defining this through the liquidity coverage ratio, through things like risk-weighted assets, and standards for suitable collateral. This raises the related question of whether there are enough liquid securities in the market. Some rudimentary work that we and others have done suggests that supply will not be a significant constraint. A little more on that later. Second, we could consider the liquidity of the institutions that make up the market. Here again, financial regulation has gone a long way towards imposing new requirements on banks, addressing capital, liquidity, and leverage. The aim is for institutions to have enough capital and liquidity to be able to weather financial market turmoil. As a practical matter, the liquidity of a financial institution will be at least partially dependent on the liquidity of the instruments it holds and the liquidity of the market for those instruments during periods of economic stress. While regulators have gone some distance towards addressing liquidity concerns for financial instruments and financial institutions, it will be important going forward to continue to focus on the role of market liquidity. This raises another set of important questions, such as how should we measure market liquidity, and how can we be sure it will not evaporate when it's most needed? As I mentioned before, there are many measures of market liquidity. In the context of reducing liquidity risk, the important thing is that liquidity assessments of financial instruments and the institutions which hold them must be dynamic and as real-time as possible. An analysis of market liquidity will be key. Liquidity stress tests should consider the particular properties of individual instruments and the likely market dynamics that will prevail in stressful situations. We know that illiquid markets can increase volatility, raising the likelihood of a destabilizing cycle where firms seek to raise liquidity in the market but are forced to do so at large discounts, thus impairing the firm's capital positions and exacerbating their liquidity problems. Over the past couple of years, market participants have raised concerns about the potential lack of liquidity in certain markets, particularly the corporate bond market, as a result of significantly reduced dealer inventories in response to changing risk appetite, evolving business models, and regulatory reforms. Dealer inventories are down by some measures as much as 80% compared to pre-crisis levels. I would note that corporate bond markets have shown strong resilience over the last several years, with record debt issuance, narrowing credit spreads, and steady inflows into corporate bond funds. But the concern is whether liquidity will evaporate in rising interest rate and weaker credit markets. So the depth and durability of market liquidity does bear directly on some of the central questions being debated on the other panels today. It also bears mentioning that concerns about market liquidity are relevant to the range of assets permitted to count toward liquidity buffers or serve as collateral. On the one hand, it's important to ensure that only the safest assets with the most reliably liquid markets are being looked to as the potential source of liquidity in times of stress. On the other hand, if all firms are forced to hold the same narrow set of assets, the selling that ensues when all firms attempt to raise liquidity could destabilize those markets. Striking the right balance would be important. Finally, I'd like to address developments that may impact the demand for and availability of safe liquid assets, as well as several structural changes in the marketplace that may have implications for market liquidity. In addition to the new regulatory requirements, which will require banks to hold higher levels of liquid assets, increased demand is also being driven by increased central clearing and the associated posting of collateral and margin with the central counterparty, and new margin requirements for uncleared swaps. By some estimates, global reforms will require financial institutions to hold several $1 trillion in additional safe assets compared to pre-crisis levels. But overall, the supply of high-quality liquid assets is still enormous. According to a recent analysis by the Bank for International Settlements, the available supply is many times the expected demand for collateral. It will be important going forward, however, to look closely at the sources of that collateral and assess the ability to match supply and demand. This may become more important as regulations take effect requiring institutions to hold large amounts of safe assets and as some sources of liquidity, such as central bank asset purchase programs, are wound down. As a natural consequence of positive economic trends, the supply of safe liquid assets is likely to shrink in coming years. For example, governments in most developed countries will be reducing their issuance of sovereign bonds as deficits continue to shrink. In the United States alone, the annual increase in marketable U.S. government debt outstanding is expected to shrink from $1.1 trillion as recently as 2012 to $620 billion in issuance this year, a decline of almost 50%. Increased demand for safe assets was one of the factors that led Treasury to develop floating rate notes, the first new product issued by Treasury in 17 years. In conversations with market participants, it became clear to us that there was real demand for a term security that reset its interest rate on a regular basis and would therefore trade with relative principal stability. Issuance is still relatively small. We just began these auctions in January. But early results have confirmed that demand for such an instrument is indeed significant. Another potential policy development that will have bearing on this question of where market participants will source liquidity in the future is the reverse repo program currently being tested by the Federal Reserve. It's possible that market participants will look to the reverse repurchase program as a substitute source for safe assets. Some commentators have noted this feature of the program, arguing that it would help expand the supply of a potentially scarce resource. It's important to note, however, that assets borrowed under the RRP, at least as currently structured, are not permitted to be rehypothecated. Accordingly, those assets would not be available for use as margin or collateral, for example. Several structural changes are underway that are changing the way market participants interact and the nature of financial intermediation. For example, there has been a broad shift away from unsecured financing to secured financing arrangements, such as repo and securities lending. There's also been a trend towards increased electronic trading and increased use of central clearing. These evolutions in market structure are broadly positive. But as always, it will be important to closely monitor these developments and the changes that they themselves bring. No one wants to run a real-time stress test of market liquidity. But if we have to, I think there are now some important mitigants to the conditions we faced in 2008, including less leverage among banks, which decreases the potential volume of sales, and more central clearing with important counterparty protections. The sudden rise in interest rates last summer provided a mini stress test, if you will, of the market's ability to absorb an interest rate shock. Overall, the markets appear to have proven resilient in the face of the bond market sell-off. According to a recent IOSCO report, smaller trade sizes and increased reliance on electronic trading helped to fill the void left by reduced dealer inventories. I'd like to close my remarks with an anecdote that sums up several of the issues that I've touched on today and is an example of the kind of liquidity issue I think we should consider. I was recently approached by a fixed income portfolio manager who asked me whether I was worried about the lack of liquidity in corporate bond markets. I replied that, of course, I was worried, but I was even more worried that he was asking me about it. I told him that he should be worried about promising to provide daily liquidity to his fund's investors if he believes the assets underlying the fund are not all that liquid. While there is an obligation on the part of policymakers to consider the impact of our actions on market liquidity, it's equally incumbent on market participants to pay close attention to liquidity and to take account of the changing environment. I have now probably asked many more questions than I have answered. So I'd like to turn it back to you and to Martin to see if you can ask me a few questions about this. Thank you so much for your attention.
the risk of being boring, I'm going to ask you a question that you raised earlier, which is the liquidity in corporate bond markets. And I guess if you think about the large corporations, their bonds seem to be very liquid. And the concern about liquidity is really about some of the small or medium-sized enterprises. I guess the very small are not going to go into the capital market, but some of the medium-sized enterprises and the lack of liquidity that there may be in those. So do you think is that a concern to you? And that's a set of firms we really sort of want to encourage, because we think a lot of the employment growth is going to come from those firms if we want to get employment and investment growing. So talk to me a little bit about the liquidity, not just of the overall market, but of some of the smaller firm bonds.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's quite a legitimate concern. And I think a few years ago, post-financial crisis, there was tremendous risk aversion among bond dealers, and they just simply didn't want to own anything that they couldn't immediately trade or transact in. I think that's gotten a little bit better, but I think what I hear is that given a new regulatory landscape, given new sort of business models that are less driven by transactions and trading revenues, I think the real problem is for smaller, less liquid securities that don't trade often in the market, there's not enough price information to really support carrying these bonds and making sure that they're deep liquid markets. Now, we are seeing some evolution in terms of, you know, investor-to-investor trading platforms. We're seeing more activity in smaller pieces. I hear this constantly, that instead of large blocks, we're seeing much smaller blocks of securities trade. And I think we do need to give it a bit of time for people to watch sort of the evolution of the market. If there's money to be made in trading these securities, I think that over time there'll be an evolution towards some greater sources of liquidity. A few years ago, I was hearing a lot of concerns about the Volcker Rule and how that would impact.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah.
So let me just jump right in there.
Go right away.
It was odd to be hearing about that years before the rule was even adopted, that this was harming corporate bond liquidity. And I think it was something that the regulators thought a lot about in really defining a very adequate, I believe, market-making exemption in the final rule. And the intent is not to stop trading and transacting in these markets, but to make sure that there's adequate compliance and risk management so that it's done in a proper way. So I think we're going to have to take some time with this, but I think it is very important that new sources of liquidity develop in the markets and that they are developed in ways that, you know, provide adequate protection.
You were active at T. Rowe Price. And so let me ask you this. We had quite a discussion on the panels earlier. I hope that's not a... No, that's someone's phone. Okay, forget it. I thought it was the fire alarm going off, which sometimes happens, although this much rain seems unlikely. I've lost my train of thought. We had several people on the panels that said, look, there was excessive intermediation in the period leading up to the crisis. So in a sense, banks were lending too much, or financial institutions were lending too much. There was just too much money sloshing around. So yes, we've introduced a new regulatory environment, and yes, it's reduced the amount of intermediation, but that's okay. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't like the sounds of too much money slushing around financing things.
Well, this was before your watch.
I missed your panel in the morning, but give me a little more color on what people were driving at in that context.
Well, that there was too much, the risk premium was too low, that we had too much money flowing into mortgages and hence into banking, into housing. Ben Bernanke has written about the savings glut and how a lot of money was flowing to the United States. And so we sort of had too much of that activity going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, this may not at all answer the question that you're raising, but I think that in the United States, we do have a very highly developed capital market system. And I think there were too many poor incentives in that system to securitize, package, and deliver risk into the capital markets that was driven by probably over-liquidity and low-risk premiums. But there are some market-correcting factors there. If things are underpriced and people lose money, eventually the prices will adjust and things will come back into balance. What you don't want to happen is for that to happen in such a disorderly way that it impairs liquidity across the markets, and secure assets, strong assets, are harmed at the same time that, you know, the more problematic assets are harmed. And I think that's what we saw in 2008.
I'm stealing again from the comments earlier, and this was one that John Dugan made. And he was talking about liquidity tools and the need for liquidity tools. And he mentioned that as a result of Dodd-Frank, as he put it, we've preserved some of the liquidity tools we have. This is, you know, Fed lending or other sources of liquidity. We've added a couple, but we've also restricted four others, and he was a bit concerned about, and I agree with him on these. So the Treasury has had the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and that was used in the crisis, and Congress kind of took that away. They can't use it for that anymore. So the Treasury really doesn't have a slush fund to bail out, liquefy the markets if they need to. The second one he mentioned was the FDIC systemic risk exception, which had been added in Fiducia, was, as he put it, rather stretched in the crisis, but actually turned out to be a very powerful source of getting us through the crisis, and that has been curtailed. And then the third one was it's now quite hard for the Fed to lend to individual institutions. It can lend under 13.3. And the final one was that it's hard to encourage bank mergers now because banks, you know, they're under a lot of pressure. They're told they're too big already, and therefore they're not going to buy another bank, or being, even if you give them a lot of encouragement, they're going to say, we don't want to do that. And in any case, you know, we don't know what we're taking on. You're going to come after us if we buy this bank. Do you think those four add up to a concern about liquidity, or you think maybe that's being overstated? How do you react to some of those?
Well, I think that broadly one of the important things that Dodd-Frank was making a distinction about was assistance provided to a failing institution versus assistance provided to solvent institutions. And I think, you know, it comes back to my point about credit impaired and liquidity impaired. And I think there are certain tools that, you know, you would drive towards a credit impaired failing institution. There are other things that are available for, you know, liquid, solvent, or illiquid, but solvent institutions that need help in the moment. And I think probably the distinction is rather important in thinking about post-financial crisis, what are the tools that policymakers have, and to make sure that they're being deployed in the right way. So, you know, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, I would say, let's not overplay that. It's not a very big fund, and
no.
It is there to help us assist in currency crises if we needed to step in and support a currency market. So it should not be, in my view, a tool that is broadly available to fix every problem that could arise in a financial crisis. And I think providing that protection was a good thing. I think that in some of the other tools, I mean, I'm not going to speak for the FDIC or its
I understand.
Its policies or authorities, but, you know, I think that generally, the thrust of the legislation in the world we're in today is to, if you're going to extend assistance, and you can do that in a broadly available context as opposed to single institutions, then you probably are addressing conditions of, you know, market systemic liquidity problems. And I think that's another feature of the legislation. Again, you know, I said no one wants to run a real-time, you know, market test on all of these things, but I think I understand the architecture and sort of the reasons for why things are designed the way they are. And part of the problem that I saw so clearly in 2008 is that people in the markets were just broadly confused. They did not understand the rules of the road or the playbook, and different solutions were being deployed in different ways for different institutions, which led to different outcomes. And If you're a bond trader or a bond investor and you have an idea of the capital structure of a company and the way it's supposed to work and the way things are supposed to work and suddenly it's not working that way, that's very, very confusing. And I think one of the benefits of the legislation in the world that we're in is that there's much more clarity about how things work in a resolution or how things can work in a market, a period of market stress.
Let me ask you a slightly broader question. The level of investment at the moment in the United States, the level of loans is pretty low, loans to assets out of the banking system or loans to deposits. It's hard to unscramble how much of this is because people are reluctant to borrow and how much of it is because people are banks or whoever are reluctant to lend. Do you get feedback from, I'm sure you do, from people out there in businesses and other folks? Does that feedback suggest to you, or do you have a sense that we are in an environment where credit is being rationed or curtailed, even though interest rates are very low? Or do you think that the market for credit, the most of the reason we're not seeing more loans is because of a reluctance to borrow?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that I find all the surveys and the data that I get to see on this question rather unsatisfying because they're generally very big aggregate numbers and they don't give me enough granularity into the issues. And I think sometimes, you know, the anecdotes can overcome, you know, the reality. And so I don't want to do that. I would say that a few years ago what I was hearing was more that it was a demand problem. Then we went into a different phase where small institutions were saying they simply didn't have access to credit or to capital. Today, we've seen some broad recovery again in the aggregate in numbers in terms of loan volume for both large and small institutions. I'd say the smaller institutions are still lagging, but they're closing the gap, and we're paying a lot of attention to that. I would say as an aside that one thing that I was very interested in a few years ago was the question of why we were seeing so little capital formation for new young companies. And this is 2011. We convened a group of small companies, exchanges, venture capitalists, sort of the whole ecosystem of small companies to say what's going on, you know, what is really happening, because we'd seen just such a sharp drop in public company IPOs, and we were hearing so much about the lack of access to capital. And I'm not talking about loans here, but just more capital. And it was an interesting exercise in trying to find out all the reasons why small companies were struggling. And what we saw were more companies choosing to sell themselves as small companies rather than to try and grow through public and private capital sources. And as you probably all know, that led to the passage of the Jobs Act the following year in 2012 to try to get at some of the causes of restrained sort of capital formation. And, you know, like every piece of legislation, you're never done when it passes. There's all sorts of rulemakings and after passage work, and we're paying a lot of attention to that. You know, we're seeing quite an increase in the number of IPOs. I certainly don't want to go back to the tech bubble of 1999, but I would like to see a healthy market for small companies. And why do we care so much about that? We care about it because we know that small companies are the biggest job creators in the country. So, you know, anything that we can do to nurture and allow that type of growth, I think, is an important contribution to the overall economy. But that leads to even more market structure questions about, you know, how do these small companies fare when they enter the public markets? And is there enough support for their stocks? Is there enough research following these companies? Do they find liquidity? Do investors fare well if they invest in these companies? And these are all ongoing, you know, policy questions. You know, last week there was a big, last 2 weeks there's been so much discussion about high-frequency trading. And, you know, one of the features of that activity is it generally focuses on deep liquid stocks of large companies.
Right.
So, you know, in a high-frequency trading book, you're not going to find a lot of the smaller companies represented. Going way off course.
That's great. So. Let me ask the audience if we have some questions. I hope we do. Okay, you're always our first in line, but I'll let you get us started.
Thank you, Mary, for being here. Bert Ely, Banking Monetary Policy Consultant. I'd like to come back to something you said in your remarks, that there might be a need for new sources of liquidity. Could you expand on that and what those new sources of liquidity might be?
I'm trying to remember what in which part of the remarks or context.
It was towards the end of your remarks. Mm-hmm. You talked about the need for new sources of liquidity. You may get remarked
on that. Okay. I think that I to introduce that idea in the context of a recent example at the Treasury of deploying our floating rate note program. You know, we have a stated desire to extend the average maturity of Treasury debt, but at the same time, when we do that, we are taking a lot of Treasury bills out of the market. And so in designing the floating rate note program, we designed an instrument that can have a term, could be 2 years, could be 5 years, could be longer, but has an interest rate reset every quarter that keeps it, the rates resets every week, which keeps the price of it very close to a T-bill and makes it a highly liquid instrument. And in part, in testing that, we were reaching out to the market and saying, is there more demand for T-bills? It seemed that there was, but we had a different objective of issuing term debt. Could we design something that might put a new source of liquidity into the market? I think I also referenced a program the Federal Reserve is testing. If you were asking the question in the context of market participants, what I was raising at the end of those remarks is really the concept that I think all market participants need to think about providing liquidity, finding liquidity, and having it. I sometimes think that the direction of regulation is largely been at the banking sector, and I think on the other side of the banking sector are the people who invest in securities. And they shouldn't be, they should not be ignorant of the fact that they may need to carry more liquidity than they did in the past if the market isn't providing the same amount of liquidity. And so the question is, where would they go to find that? What are the new instruments? What are the things that could supply that? Sure.
More questions? Yes, Paul.
Mary, thank you very much for your insightful remarks. You'd made the point about the importance of the banking system self-insuring and not necessarily relying on the lender of last resort as the sole or exclusive source of liquidity. But do you recognize at some point, at least conceptually, that there is a cost of over-insuring? In other words, is there a cost to economic growth associated with too much liquidity in the system, and how do we go about evaluating that trade-off?
Well, I certainly wish I had the answer to that question. We don't know. I mean, we're just in the early, you know, as they say, in the foothills of understanding sort of how the financial landscape is adjusting to liquidity requirements, capital requirements, et cetera. I think initially we were concerned initially about are there enough instruments out there to meet the demand for what the regulatory environment is setting up here, and I'd say our early answer is yes. But there's some areas where I see some reduction in things like sovereign debt that may be bringing down the supply. And whether that has an impact on costs, we don't know yet. So I applaud the desire to put more liquidity in the system. There is nothing more gut-wrenching than not being able to find liquidity when you need it. And I've been there, so I applaud the steps that we're taking to put more liquidity into financial institutions. I think what I was saying is I think there are other market participants who have an equal obligation to think about these questions too.
Let me ask you a question on the international front. When you travel overseas, you sometimes get the reaction, well, America's just doing all this financial regulation. It's not really paying attention to what other countries are doing. And I know that's unfair, but are you satisfied with the extent of coordination that we've been able to achieve in liquidity regulation or perhaps other areas of regulation? Is this something that you are involved with regularly, meeting with your counterparts in Europe or in Asia?
Well, I should begin by saying that, of course, I sit over the domestic finance operations of the Treasury.
I know,
but there are many ways we touch, you know,
exactly,
the international sector. Many of my visits in international circles have been really to talk about the Treasury market with foreign investors. And I would say there that I am always so impressed with the confidence and trust people place in the Treasury market and the importance of providing liquidity to the world through the Treasury market is always driven home when I have these meetings and talk to people. On the financial regulatory side, I'm interested in sort of the pace of development, the take-up of some of the ideas that the U.S. has led with. I recognize that when you lead on anything, you become a lightning rod for all sorts of critiques and constructive comments about our regulatory process. Most recently, I was on a trip to Asia to try to do a sort of checkup on sort of where they are on a number of things. And I'm interested in particular on the sort of evolution in derivatives markets regulation. And recently, I've been very interested in the trade repositories and whether they will deliver on the promise of good insight into markets and exposures. So I was having a lot of those discussions with our Asian counterparts. And I think what I felt there was that there had been somewhat of a wait-and-see attitude to see what is the U.S. and possibly Europe going to serve up together and should we adopt or follow or engage here. What I felt on this trip was a lot more interest in engaging and sitting down at the table and sort of closing the gaps. People often talk to me about regulatory arbitrage and whether, you know, things are going to leave the United States and go to other markets where it is more lightly regulated. I actually don't sign up for that at all. I know in my own experience when I was managing assets for clients, I did not look around the world to try to find the most lightly regulated market where I could put my clients' money at risk. We were looking for good returns, but we also wanted to do it in places where we had the rule of law, we had good regulatory frameworks, and that we felt there were adequate protections. And I think that's the way people are looking at the United States. I mean, there's a lot going on here, a lot's under construction, but I think if at the end of the day we restore confidence in the regulatory framework, the safety and soundness questions, I think there's a lot of opportunity for others to follow.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you that the safety and soundness of the U.S. system is definitely one of its attractions and brings a lot of funds to the United States. I do hear, though, that derivatives trading some of that may be shifting overseas. Is that something you've heard, and are you concerned about that, or do you sort of feel good riddance to some of them?
No. I think we're in the early days of bringing up swap execution facilities and ironing out differences between regulatory regimes in the U.S. and other countries. I do think that there's some coming deadlines where Europe will be bringing into play regulations that will be narrowing the gap between the U.S. and Europe, and I think that our regulators have extended a lot of sort of time relief to sort of allow that convergence to happen. So early days, I'm watching the derivatives trading activity pretty carefully on CEFs and how that's evolving and developing. I just mentioned I'm very interested in the trade reporting side of this and how much insight we have into that. And frankly, I think there's a lot of work to be done to make this framework strong. But I do like, you know, what I'm seeing in terms of the bones of what's been built.
Can I see if there's a... Come on, we need to get the audience. Yes, there we go. Marcus, good for you.
Thank you. You made reference a couple of times in your remarks and in answer to one of the questions as well for better discipline and practices and perhaps more self-insurance by the buy side, by investors and asset managers. And, of course, that's been an issue of some controversy recently. There's been kind of a push by asset managers to claim that they don't pose systemic risk, and several SEC commissioners have spoken out about how this is not an appropriate area for prudential regulators to move into. Did you want to comment on that controversy at all, or perhaps on the Fed's upcoming wholesale funding rule and how that might move across both buy and sell side?
Mm-hmm. I can't comment on the latter thing. On the first topic, as you know, as probably most people know, there's a new group that Treasury chairs, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is charged with looking broadly across the financial landscape and making sure that there are no gaps in terms of understanding or oversight or no ability for risk to develop that could threaten financial stability. So in the process of looking across the financial landscape, we are looking at the asset management industry. And I'd say that that is still in the early stages of review to look at the activities of asset managers and to try to determine whether they present risks to the financial system that requires further oversight. I'm always very careful to say that we're really, you know, no judgments have been made, you know, no decisions have been made. It's really a deep dive right now to understand the features of the industry, the practices of the industry, and I would say, based on my own experience too, that it is a very heterogeneous industry. So trying to understand the full range of players in the market and what sorts of activities they engage in is what we're up to right now. So I think, you know, the topic you're so interested in today is of great interest to asset managers. So,
well, you were an asset manager, and one of the arguments that my colleague Doug has made is that to what extent, when you're looking at asset managers, if they are in the business of pass-through, in other words, if they are basically doing what their clients want mm-hmm. them to do, so if their clients want to sell U.S. stocks or foreign stocks or technology stocks or bonds or something like that, does that mean that the asset manager is a systemic risk, or are they simply reflecting the variability that's going to be natural if people get spooked by certain kinds of assets and want to mm-hmm. move in or out of them?
I think the question you're getting at is whether the asset manager is acting as a principal or an agent.
I should have said it in that clearer way.
I think for the most part, asset managers are serving as agents. I think, you know, where the risk can arise is if there is a stampede out of an asset class at the same time and everybody is selling at the same time. And, you know, whether there is, you know, collateral damage. I remember another feature of 2008 when certain classes of assets became highly illiquid and you couldn't sell them, then you sold the thing that you could sell. So we were seeing very odd outcomes where, you know, high quality assets that were very liquid were performing as badly as, you know, lower quality assets that you would expect to be illiquid. So I think, you know, just sort of understanding, you know, how, you know, the assets are deployed and watching the flows and trends and seeing that, you know, there's adequate liquidity to meet demand when you need it. That's the key question. So I think I probably have
to. You need to go. So thank you so much.
Yeah.